Welcome to Lindy Upgrade Studio. Our TOEFL reading podcast helps you build the background knowledge, academic vocabulary, and useful expressions behind real TOEFL reading passages. So whether you're out for a run at the gym, on your commute, or doing chores around the house, pop in your earbuds and let English sink in naturally.
It's great to have you here.
Yeah, so I want you to start by just imagining that your city's water supply suddenly vanishes tomorrow morning. Like, you wake up, you walk into your bathroom, turn the faucet to brush your teeth, and just absolutely nothing happens.
Just dry air, right?
Exactly. Just dry air. Maybe a few drops rattle out, and you think, oh, it's just a temporary issue on my street. But then, you know, you look out the window, your neighbors are out there experiencing the exact same thing.
Oh, man. Panic sets in pretty fast.
Fast, right. By the afternoon, the grocery stores are totally emptied out of bottled water. By day two, hospitals can't even sanitize their equipment. By day three, the whole modern sanitation system, the toilets, the sewers, it all just completely fails.
And you can only imagine the smell. It would turn toxic so quickly.
It really would. Within a single week, a modern metropolis of millions of people would be thrown into this absolute irreversible chaos. People would literally have to pack bags, abandon their homes, and physically walk to wherever the nearest natural river or lake is just to survive.
It's terrifying when you actually stop and think about it.
It is, because we rarely think about water until it stops flowing. We just take it completely for granted. But thousands of years ago, humanity faced this exact ticking clock every single day.
They absolutely did.
So if we look back at our last deep dive, we were looking at TOEFL Article 40, which was all about expert systems. You know, artificial intelligence, algorithms, digital networks.
Right, all the digital infrastructure.
Yeah, but today, we are completely leaving the digital age behind. We are opening up TOEFL Article 41, which is titled Ancient Aqueducts. We're traveling back thousands of years to look at the physical structures that kept millions of people from dying of thirst.
It's a massive shift in time, for sure. But, you know, interestingly, the underlying theme is exactly the same.
Wait, really? How so?
Well, whether it's a computer network processing digital data or a stone channel processing physical water, we're still talking about complex systems designed to solve fundamental human problems.
Oh, that's a great point.
Yeah, and my role today is to guide you through the language describing these ancient systems. We're going to explore the physical mechanics of these structures while simultaneously breaking down the academic English used in the text.
Because for a TOEFL learner like someone at a B1 or B2 level trying to push into that C1 territory, this kind of reading passage is incredibly dense, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's packed with high-level vocabulary, really complex sentence structures, subtle academic transitions. When you sit down for your exam, we do not want you to just stare at this wall of text and try to translate it word by word in your head.
That is the worst feeling, just getting stuck on every single word.
Right. It's exhausting. We want you to see the architecture of the language instead. We want you to understand the Latin roots hidden inside these words so you can guess the meaning of things you've never even seen before.
Yeah, and building that background knowledge so deeply that when you read about a water channel, you instantly visualize the engineering and the society behind it.
Visualizing it is the key to reading comprehension.
So to really understand this, let's strip the concept down to its absolute core. The source text begins with this very bold statement. It says, "Aqueducts are among the most impressive engineering feats of ancient civilizations. Aqueducts are structures built to transport water from a distant source to cities and towns."
It's a strong opening.
It is. But before we even get into who built them, we have to look at the central word, aqueduct. I mean, it sounds very formal, very academic, but it's actually built from very simple ancient building blocks, isn't it?
It really is. It's a phenomenal word for language learners to study, actually, because it perfectly illustrates how modern English is built on the bones of older languages.
Like Latin.
Exactly. If you want to expand your vocabulary quickly, you have to stop memorizing whole words and start learning the roots. So let's break aqueduct right in half.
Okay, let's do it.
The first half is aqua. This comes straight from ancient Latin, and it simply means water. And once you know this root, a whole new world of vocabulary opens up.
You see it everywhere.
Everywhere. When you go look at fish in a glass tank, you're at an aquarium. If you're talking about sports in a pool, those are aquatic sports.
Or like the light blue color, aquamarine.
Yes. Or even in astrology, the sign for the water carrier is Aquarius.
Oh, I didn't even think of that one. It really is everywhere.
It is. Now, let's look at the second half of the word, duct. This comes from the Latin verb ducere, which translates to to lead or to guide.
To lead. Okay, so when you fuse them together, aqua and duct, you literally get to lead water.
That is the literal translation. An aqueduct is nothing more complicated than a structure designed to lead water from one location to another.
That makes it so much less intimidating.
Right. And just like aqua, that root douceur is hiding in dozens of high-level academic words for the TOEFL. Think about the word conduct.
Like conducting an orchestra. You're leading the musicians.
Exactly. Or conducting an experiment where you guide the scientific process. Even the word educate comes from this root. The prefix e means out, and douceur means to lead.
So to educate someone literally means to lead them out of ignorance.
To lead them into knowledge, yes.
Wow, I find that endlessly fascinating. It's like looking at the skeleton of the English language.
Yeah.
It makes learning new words feel like solving a puzzle, you know, rather than just staring at a flashcard.
It's a much better way to learn.
So moving on in the text, the author doesn't just call an aqueduct a building or a pipe. They use this specific phrase. They call it an impressive engineering feat, and feat is spelled F-E-A-T.
Yes, very important distinction from F-E-E-T.
Right. I feel like this is a word that a lot of intermediate learners might recognize when they read it, but they probably don't use it in their everyday speech. It carries a specific weight, doesn't it?
It does, and it's a critical collocation for academic reading. Engineering feat appears constantly in historical and scientific texts. A feat isn't just a regular accomplishment.
Like making my bed in the morning is an accomplishment, but it's definitely not a feat.
Definitely not. A feat is a triumph. It's an achievement requiring an extraordinary amount of courage, or immense physical strength, or incredible mental skill.
Like the myths, right? The 12 feats of Hercules.
Exactly, the 12 feats of Hercules. It implies the task was unbelievably difficult, the odds of failure were extremely high, and yet they managed to succeed.
So when the author calls these aqueducts an engineering feat, they're telling us this wasn't just some casual weekend construction project.
No, it was a monumental triumph of human intelligence over a really harsh physical world.
And the primary goal of this triumph, according to the text, was to transport water.
Which gives us another great root analysis opportunity. Transport.
Okay, let's break it down.
The prefix trans means across or beyond. You see it in transatlantic.
Across the Atlantic Ocean.
Right. Or translate, carrying meaning across languages.
Yeah.
And the second part, port, comes from porter, meaning to carry.
So transport literally means to carry something across a distance.
Yes, and we use this constantly. Export is to carry goods out. Import is to carry goods in.
If something is portable, you can carry it with you.
Exactly. You're getting the hang of this root system.
It's so logical when you look at it that way. So an aqueduct is an engineering feat designed to carry water across a great distance. But I want to pause here. I want to really dig into the stakes of this situation.
Okay. What do you mean?
Well, why was carrying water such an existential problem for the ancient world? Because for you and me living today, moving water is totally invisible. If I'm thirsty, I just walk 10 steps to my sink, pull a handle, and clean cold water pours into my glass.
You don't even have to think about it.
I don't. I'm not thinking about the reservoir 50 miles away or the electric pumps. But for these ancient civilizations, moving water was like this ultimate, inescapable barrier to human progress.
It truly was. If we zoom out to the broader historical context, the entire trajectory of human civilization is dictated by water availability.
Because you can't build a city without it.
Right. An ancient city is essentially a living organism, and water is its blood. If a city doesn't have a mechanical system to transport water from far away, it's trapped by its geography.
It can only grow as large as the local water supply allows.
Exactly. Say you build a village next to a small river. That river provides enough drinking, washing, and farming water for, let's say, 5,000 people. You build houses, markets, you thrive up to that limit.
But the moment you reach 5,001 citizens,
you have a crisis. The river cannot produce any more water. Once you hit that maximum capacity, all growth must stop. If you try to expand anyway, people will literally die of dehydration.
Or disease, right? I'd imagine the water gets polluted really fast.
Oh, incredibly fast. Too many people using a small river for drinking and waste disposal leads to massive outbreaks of cholera or dysentery. You can't expand your military or your economy without a massive surplus of fresh water.
I always try to use a physical analogy here to help listeners really internalize this struggle. Like, imagine you have a large empty swimming pool in your backyard.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
And your goal for the day is to fill this pool, but you don't have a hose, no outdoor faucet. The only source of water is a natural lake 2 miles away.
That sounds awful already.
It gets worse. To fill the pool, you have to take 2 heavy wooden buckets, walk 2 miles to the lake, fill them until they're insanely heavy, and physically carry them 2 miles back.
And then you dump it in and it barely covers the bottom of the pool.
Exactly. Now imagine doing that backbreaking walk hundreds of times a day. And you have to do this every single day of your life, not for a fun pool, but just so your family doesn't die of thirst.
It's an impossible way to live. The sheer physical energy required is staggering.
Right. So an aqueduct is basically a giant permanent stone hose that does all that heavy lifting for you automatically 24 hours a day.
Never needs to rest.
But this brings up a massive logistical question for me. If they didn't have electric pumps or steam engines, how do they get millions of gallons of water to move across these huge distances? Water only moves when it's forced to, or when it's falling.
You've hit on the exact engineering problem that makes these structures so legendary, and it's exactly what the author explores next.
What does the text say?
It says, the Romans in particular perfected the construction of aqueducts, using gravity to carry water over long distances. Roman aqueducts were made of stone, brick, and concrete, and included tunnels, bridges, and pipes.
Okay, there is a very important academic transition phrase buried in there that I want to highlight. The Romans in particular.
Yes, in particular is a vital tool for any student aiming for a high score in TOEFL writing or speaking. It's a transitional device meaning specifically.
So the author's taking a broad concept, ancient civilizations building water channels, and zooming in on one specific example.
Exactly. It tells the reader, pay attention to this group. They're the most important example of our topic.
And the text makes a really strong claim about them. It says the Romans perfected the construction. Usually I hear perfect used as an adjective, like she got a perfect score or the weather is perfect.
Right, but here it's functioning as an action, a verb. And notice the subtle shift in pronunciation, too.
Oh, yeah. P-erfect versus perfect.
Exactly. As an adjective, the stress is on the first syllable, P-erft. But as a verb, it shifts. Perfect. To perfect something means taking a tool or idea that already exists and continuously improving it until it's completely free from flaws.
So they didn't invent moving water.
No. Other civilizations had tried it, but the Romans took the concept and elevated it to its highest possible level of efficiency. And the engine they used to drive this perfected system, like you asked about, was gravity.
Gravity, just the invisible force pulling everything down toward the center of the Earth.
Which is wild, because in almost every other ancient construction project, gravity is your worst enemy.
It's constantly trying to pull your roof down and collapse your walls.
Exactly. You have to build thick columns just to fight it. But the Roman engineers stopped fighting gravity and they weaponized it. They turned it into their engine. It's a profound shift in perspective. But harnessing gravity requires a level of mathematical precision that is truly mind-boggling, especially considering their technology at the time.
Because they didn't have GPS or computer modeling.
They had none of that. To make water flow consistently over dozens of miles, the channel had to be built on a constant, unyielding, but incredibly slight downward slope.
Let's really unpack the mechanics of this slope, because this is the real engineering feat. Say you're a Roman engineer bringing water from a mountain to a city 40 miles away. If you build the slope too steep, dropping several feet a mile, what happens? Why not just let it rush down quickly?
Because fast-moving water is incredibly destructive. If it rushes down a steep incline inside a stone channel, the friction, velocity, and pressure act like a giant saw.
Wow, just tearing it apart.
Over months and years, it will violently erode the mortar, tear apart the stones, and blow the walls completely apart. Building it too steep means destroying it from the inside out.
Okay, so you can't go too steep. What if you're too cautious? What if you build it too flat with barely any slope?
Then the water stops moving. It pools together and stagnates. And stagnant water in an open-air channel under the Mediterranean sun is a disaster.
Oh, bacteria.
Bacteria, algae, mosquitoes, it becomes toxic. Delivering a stagnant, disease-ridden pool of water completely defeats the purpose of an aqueduct.
So they had to calculate this mathematical middle ground.
Yes. They had to maintain a precise drop, sometimes just a few inches for every single mile, across mountains, valleys, and plains for 40 or 50 miles straight.
Just a few inches a mile. I want to offer another visual for the listeners here. Imagine a smooth wooden ramp, 20 miles long. You place a heavy glass marble at the top. The angle of that whole 20-mile ramp has to be so perfect that the marble rolls all the way to the end without stopping in a flat spot, but without ever picking up enough speed to bounce off the track.
That's a perfect way to visualize it.
And now imagine building that 20-mile ramp out of massive boulders, tunneling through solid rock, and building bridges over river gorges, all without changing the angle. It's just hard to comprehend.
It requires an absolute mastery of mathematics and surveying.
But speaking of materials, there's a word in the text that caught my attention. It says they used stone, brick, and concrete. Now, stone and brick makes sense. But concrete? Why concrete? Isn't that a modern invention for highways and skyscrapers?
That's a very sharp observation. Mentioning concrete here is not a casual detail. It represents one of the most important technological breakthroughs in human history.
Wait, really? The Romans invented concrete.
They invented a revolutionary, highly specific type of volcanic ash concrete called pozzolana. And you have to think about the properties of water to understand why this was so crucial.
Okay, water is sneaky.
Exactly. If you just stack regular carved stones to build a channel, there will be microscopic gaps. Water is relentless. It will find those cracks, seep through the mortar, and drain into the earth.
So if you send water through 40 miles of just stacked stone,
you'll lose 70, 80, maybe 90% of your water to leakage before it ever reaches the city walls.
You do all that math with gravity just to water the dirt along the way.
Right. But Roman volcanic concrete solved this entirely. It had a unique chemical property. It was completely waterproof.
Wow.
And even more miraculously, the chemical reaction of the volcanic ash meant the concrete actually hardened and cured while submerged underwater.
Modern concrete degrades in water, doesn't it?
Often, yes. But Roman concrete grew stronger over time when exposed to water. So they'd build the main arches out of stone, but line the interior channel where the water actually flowed with this waterproof concrete.
Creating a perfectly smooth, watertight seal.
Exactly. They could transport millions of gallons over 50 miles and barely lose a single drop.
So they weren't just mastering physics, they were mastering chemistry too.
Physics, mathematics, chemistry, and brutal physical labor. All in one unified system.
It's no wonder the author said they perfected it.
Mm-hmm.
So once this perfected system brings this monumental volume of water into Rome, it fundamentally changes society, right?
It changed what it meant to be a human living in a crowded space.
Let's see how the text describes this. It says, the aqueducts were essential to the growth and sustainability of Roman cities. They supplied water for public baths, fountains, households, and agriculture.
Let's start with the vocabulary in that first half, because it has some foundational academic expressions. The author says aqueducts were essential to the growth.
Essential to. I see that collocation everywhere.
You will encounter it in almost every academic discipline. It means something is absolutely vital, completely necessary, and indispensable. Condition A cannot exist without condition B.
Like oxygen is essential to human life.
Exactly. In this context, the massive population growth of Rome was physically impossible without the aqueducts.
And it says they were essential not just to growth, but to sustainability. Now, this is a huge C1 level word. We hear it all the time in modern news, sustainable energy, sustainable farming. But what does it actually mean at its core?
To find the core, we return to the Latin roots. Sustainability is built on two primary pieces. The prefix sus, a variation of sub, means up or from below.
Okay, up from below.
And the second part, tane, comes from the root tenor, which means to hold. So the literal structural meaning is the ability to hold something up from below.
Oh, to hold it up so it doesn't fall.
Right. In a broader sense, it means the ability to maintain something at a certain rate or level over a long period of time without it collapsing.
So how does that apply to ancient Rome?
Well, at its peak, Rome swelled to about 1 million people. 1 million people packed tightly together in pre-industrial conditions is a very fragile, precarious situation.
Right, highly unstable.
A city of that size cannot sustain itself. It cannot hold itself up against disease, starvation, and thirst without a massive daily influx of fresh water. The aqueducts provided that sustainability. They prevented the city from collapsing under its own weight.
That makes the concept so clear.
Mm.
Without water holding it up, society crumbles. And then the author lists four specific areas where this water was supplied. Public baths, fountains, households, and agriculture. You know, when taking a reading test, it's so easy to just scan over a list like that. You see four nouns, you think, okay, a list of places, you just move on.
But active reading, the kind that gets you a top TOEFL score, requires you to pause and ask why the author chose those four distinct examples.
So lists in academic texts aren't random.
Rarely. An author doesn't just throw darts at a dictionary. This specific list was carefully constructed to represent the different layers, classes, and functions of Roman society. By listing these four, the author shows how deeply the water penetrated every aspect of daily life.
Let's break them down. First on the list, public baths.
Right. In the Roman world, public baths, the thermae, weren't just big bathtubs. They were massive, elaborate architectural complexes that served as the absolute center of social and cultural life.
Like a combination of a luxury spa, a community center, a gym, and a country club.
Precisely. You'd go there to exercise, socialize, debate politics, conduct business, and from a public health perspective, they were revolutionary.
Because they didn't know about germs yet.
Exactly. No medical knowledge of germs or antibiotics. So providing a space for hundreds of thousands of people to wash daily in clean running water drastically reduced infectious diseases.
So baths represent public health and social cohesion. What about the next one? Fountains. Today, we build fountains just to look nice in a park.
But in ancient Rome, these weren't just decorative art pieces. They represented public access and basic survival for the lower classes.
Because regular people didn't have indoor plumbing.
Right. The wealthy might, but the commoners, laborers, shopkeepers, they lived in crowded apartment buildings with no running water.
So they had to go to the public square to get it.
Yes. The public fountains were strategically placed on street corners everywhere. Everyday people went with clay jugs to collect their daily drinking and cooking water. The aqueducts kept them flowing 24 hours a day. The fountains were the lifeblood of the common citizen.
Okay, third on the list is households.
This represents private wealth and extreme luxury. If you were a highly successful politician or a wealthy merchant in a massive villa, you could actually pay a special tax to have a private lead pipe tap directly from the aqueduct into your home.
Wow, straight into the house.
Yes. You could have private courtyards with personal fountains, private baths, and running water in your kitchen. It was the ultimate status symbol in ancient Rome.
That's like the ancient equivalent of owning a private jet. It just screamed wealth. And then finally, the list concludes with agriculture.
Returning to the root of human survival, the word agriculture has great roots too. Ager means field, and cultura means growing or cultivation. So cultivation of fields.
Even outside the city walls, they were using this water for farming.
They had to. They needed to grow massive amounts of wheat, olives, and grapes to feed the city, the expanding army, the empire. Without agricultural irrigation, the food supply chain breaks.
So looking back at that single sentence, baths, fountains, households, and agriculture. Just four words. But the authors showed that water touched public health. The daily survival of the poor, the luxury of the rich, and the economic engine of the whole empire.
The water touched absolutely everyone.
That is how you read actively. You don't just read the nouns, you read the societal structures behind them. It really makes you reflect on how fragile our modern existence is, honestly.
We have a lot of historical amnesia about that.
We do. Because we have Wi-Fi, we think we're separate from the ancient world. But if you take away water pressure today, our civilization collapses just as fast as Rome would have. These structures were literal lifelines. And what's staggering is that some of these lifelines, built 2,000 years ago, are still physically sitting there today.
Yes, and the text gives us a specific historical example of exactly that.
Let's read it. One famous example is the Pont de God in France. Built in the first century AD, it spans 50 kilometers and features a three-tiered bridge that remains standing today.
There is a wealth of rich descriptive vocabulary here. Let's look at the primary verb, spans. The text says it spans 50 kilometers. In architecture and engineering, to span means to extend continuously from one side of something to the other, covering the distance in between.
A bridge spans a river. A tree spans a creek.
Exactly. And the distance this aqueduct spans is incredible, 50 kilometers.
For our listeners using miles, that's roughly 31 miles. That is longer than a marathon carved entirely out of stone.
And to cross the deepest valleys along that route, they built a three-tiered bridge. Let's explain this compound adjective, specifically the suffix tiered. A tier is a distinct level or layer, usually stacked vertically.
Like in a sports stadium, the lower tier, middle tier, upper tier?
Right. Or a traditional wedding cake is often three-tiered. A large base, medium on top, small on top of that.
So a three-tiered bridge, they built a massive row of arches. then a second level on top of the first, and a third level on top of the second.
Exactly. This lets them carry the water channel incredibly high in the air to maintain that perfect mathematical gravity slope we discussed without the bridge collapsing under its own weight.
The visual of the Pont du Gard is absolutely stunning. If you're listening right now, do a quick image search for it. My best modern analogy is a three-story concrete parking garage, but imagine stretching that parking garage out until it's 30 miles long.
That really puts it in perspective.
And building it out of gigantic boulders. No modern steel reinforcement, no diesel cranes, no computers. Just muscle, rope, stone, and human willpower. And the crazy part is the final phrase of that sentence. It remains standing today.
Remains standing is a really powerful academic idiom. When an author says a structure remains standing in historical writing, it's a profound testament to its durability. It implies defiance against impossible odds.
I mean, think about what it survived.
2 millennia of violent rainstorms, howling winds, freezing winters, scorching summers, earthquakes.
The fall of the Roman Empire, the Middle Ages, European wars, the Industrial Revolution, all of that history watched over it, and the stones haven't moved. It remains standing.
It's incredible.
Before we move on from the Pont du Gard, I want to ask a specific grammar question about that sentence. I feel like this structure appears constantly in high-level TOEFL passages, and it trips up learners. The sentence starts, built in the first century AD, it spans 50 kilometers. Why start with an e-ed verb phrase like that?
Ah, I'm very glad you pointed that out. This is a crucial grammatical lesson. What you're looking at is called a participial phrase. Built in the first century AD functions entirely as an adjective.
An adjective modifying the subject.
Yes. It gives more information about the subject of the main clause that immediately follows the comma. Here, the subject is it, referring back to the Pont du Gard. Authors use this structure constantly for efficiency. It condenses multiple pieces of information into one elegant sentence.
So if they didn't use it, how would they write it?
They'd have to write two separate, somewhat repetitive sentences. The Pont du Gard was built in the first century AD. It spans 50 kilometers.
Oh, yeah, that sounds a bit childish, like a beginner reading book.
Exactly. By using the participial phrase, the author compresses the historical timeline and the physical description into one smooth thought. You could say, exhausted from a long journey, the travelers fell asleep. Or, fascinated by the stars, the woman bought a telescope.
That is incredibly helpful. So whenever a TOEFL student sees a sentence begin with an e-ed or ing verb phrase followed by a comma, they should just know it's providing background info about the subject coming right up.
Right. Recognizing this pattern takes all the fear out of reading long, complex sentences.
Okay, we've spent a lot of time focusing on Rome, Roman engineering, Roman concrete. But reading effectively means paying close attention when an author shifts the spotlight. The text is about to pivot away from Rome entirely.
Let's see the transition.
It says, aqueducts were not unique to the Roman Empire. Ancient Greece, Persia, and India also developed systems for water transport.
This sentence introduces a highly functional academic phrase, unique to. If a characteristic or invention is unique to a person, place, or culture, it belongs exclusively to them.
Like kangaroos are unique to Australia.
Or your fingerprint is unique to you. But pay close attention to the grammar here. The author is using the negative form. They explicitly state that aqueducts were not unique to the Roman Empire.
This is a classic academic pivot. I always point this out to listeners because it helps you predict what the author will do next. Why spend a whole paragraph praising the Romans, calling it perfected, showing us the Pont du Gard, only to suddenly zoom out to Greece, Persia, and India?
Because a high-level academic text has to provide a comprehensive, balanced overview. It can't be one-sided. This is a common strategy. The author hooks the reader with the most famous, visually spectacular example. Everyone knows the Romans.
Right.
But to maintain academic credibility, they must broaden the scope. By pivoting to Greece, Persia, and India, the author is making a profound argument. Moving water isn't a Roman trait. It's a universal human necessity.
Every major civilization had to confront this exact same existential problem to survive.
Exactly.
But because their environments were different, they didn't solve it the same way. Which brings us to what I think is the most fascinating and frankly terrifying part of this deep dive. Ancient Persia.
Let's read their solution.
It states, Persian aqueducts, known as kanats, were underground channels, tapping groundwater sources. These systems were exceptionally durable and could last for centuries.
This is a brilliant contrast to the Roman engineering. We have some highly descriptive vocabulary here, too. Let's look at tapping.
In everyday English, tapping just means lightly striking something with your finger, tapping on a glass window.
Right, but in an industrial or resource management context, tapping means something entirely different. It means to pierce a vessel or exploit a hidden resource to draw liquid out of it.
Like tapping a maple tree for syrup.
Or drilling down to tap an oil field beneath the ocean. In this text, the Persians are tapping a natural resource.
And that resource is groundwater, which is pretty straightforward. Water held underground in the soil or trapped in solid rock aquifers.
Yes.
So look at this dramatic contrast. The Romans conquered their water problem by building towering, sky-high bridges for everyone to see, a display of dominance. But the Persians went the exact opposite direction. They dug deep, dark, invisible underground channels. Why would two brilliant civilizations take such radically different approaches?
To understand the engineering, you have to understand the geography and climate. It connects back to environmental science. The Roman Empire was centered around the Mediterranean, mild, temperate, humid.
Okay.
But Persia, located in modern-day Iran, features a harsh, arid, incredibly hot, desert-like climate. Let's do a thought experiment. If Persian engineers copied the Romans and built a 50-kilometer open-air stone channel across the desert, what happens to the water?
Oh, an absolute disaster. The blazing sun would just bake the water, would heat up and entirely evaporate into the dry air before it traveled 10 miles.
They'd just be delivering hot air to the city. The evaporation rate would render a Roman-style aqueduct totally useless.
Wow. So the Persian feat wasn't about conquering gravity with arches. It was about adapting to a hostile environment.
Brilliantly adapting. By keeping the water deep underground in these qanats, they shielded it from the relentless sun. The earth acted as a natural insulator, keeping the water cool, clean, and safe from evaporation.
That is brilliant. My mental analogy for this is, if the Roman aqueduct is like a giant stone water slide in the sky, the Persian qanat is like taking a massive underground straw, sticking it straight into the earth's hidden moisture pockets, and quietly sucking that cold water back to the city in the shade.
That's exactly how it functioned.
But I have to pause and just think about the brutal physical reality of creating these. The text says they were exceptionally durable. Break down that phrase first, and then I have a serious logistical question.
Sure. Exceptionally durable is a fantastic collocation. The adverb exceptionally means far out of the ordinary, unusually excellent, or extreme. It stems from exception, breaking normal rules.
And durable.
From the Latin root durus, translating to hard, tough, or lasting. So the author is saying these qanats possess an unusual, almost unbelievable capacity to withstand wear and damage over immense periods of time without collapsing, which they confirm by saying they could last for centuries.
Okay, so they were incredibly tough. But here's my question, and this is what terrifies me. If we dig a tunnel today, like for a subway, we bring in massive boring machines, electric floodlights, heavy-duty ventilation fans pumping fresh oxygen down the shaft.
Of course, standard safety.
The ancient Persians were digging these underground straws miles into the earth, hundreds of feet below the surface. No electricity, no modern fans, just hand tools. How did they breathe? How did they see what they were hitting? I get claustrophobic just thinking about being trapped in the pitch black, miles underground, hacking at solid rock, hoping the ceiling doesn't crush me.
It is genuinely one of the most dangerous, frightening construction methods in human history. The laborers, known as mukonis, faced unimaginable risks. To breathe and see, they dug a series of vertical shafts like little chimneys, straight down from the desert surface into the horizontal tunnel.
Oh, like air vents.
Yes. They were spaced out every few dozen meters along the entire route. They let a tiny bit of sunlight reach the tunnel and allowed workers to haul excavated dirt up in buckets. But most importantly, they acted as primitive ventilation, letting fresh air cycle down so workers wouldn't asphyxiate from lack of oxygen or rock dust.
Even with those shafts, that is unbelievably dangerous, back-breaking work. Cave-ins must have been a constant deadly threat.
A constant threat. It really highlights the immense human costs behind these monuments. We look at the ruins and think they're beautiful, but they were built with sweat, blood, and immense suffering.
Which provides a natural, though heavy, transition into the final phase of this deep dive. All this brilliance, whether soaring bridges in France or dark tunnels in Iran, brings up an unavoidable economic reality. The bill eventually comes due. These things cost money and labor.
Let's read the final two sentences of the text. However, constructing and maintaining aqueducts required significant resources and labor. Despite these challenges, aqueducts were essential investments in ancient infrastructure and played a crucial role in development.
There are several massive academic concepts packed in there. Let's start with maintaining.
This is a beautiful word to analyze. The modern meaning is so connected to its physical roots. Maintain comes from two Latin components, manus, meaning hand.
Like manual labor or handwritten manuscript.
Exactly. And the second is tenere, which we discussed with sustainability. It means to hold, so thousands of years ago, to maintain something literally meant to hold it safely in your hands, to protect it physically.
And today it means keeping a structure or system in good working condition by constantly checking and repairing it.
Right. And repairing an aqueduct was no small task. The text says it required significant resources and labor, which means massive amounts of physical materials, engineering talent, and financial capital.
Because it's so easy to think that once they built it, they just walked away and let it run forever.
But water from natural springs carries microscopic minerals, particularly calcium. As millions of gallons flowed through these pipes year after year, that calcium would slowly precipitate out and build up on the inside walls.
Just like cholesterol plaque building up inside an artery.
Exactly like that. If ignored, the calcium would grow thicker and thicker until the pipe was completely clogged and the city's water supply would just stop.
So they couldn't just walk away. They needed full-time maintenance crews.
Massive crews. The Roman government employed huge teams of slaves and laborers whose entire miserable job was to squeeze into these dark, wet, cramped tunnels on a schedule and physically chip away the rock-hard calcium buildup with hammers and chisels.
An endless, exhausting cycle of manual labor.
Exactly as the text describes.
And yet, despite the terrifying danger, the constant need to chip away calcium by hand, the massive financial drain, the author reaches a firm conclusion. They say these structures were essential investments in ancient infrastructure. Let's highlight that word. Infrastructure.
If there is one single C1 level word you take away from this entire deep dive, it should be infrastructure. It's a true academic star. You'll see it in reading sections about economics, history, urban planning, a political science, everywhere.
Let's break it down, because it looks intimidating, but the roots will clarify it.
The prefix infra means below or underneath. Think of infrared light, which exists just below the visible spectrum. And the second half is simply structure. So literally the underlying structure.
The structure that sits underneath everything else.
In a societal context, infrastructure refers to the foundational, underlying, physical, and organizational systems a society requires to function on a daily basis.
The foundation every other aspect of human life is built upon.
Exactly. For the Romans and Persians, their infrastructure was the aqueducts, the stone roads, the ports. For us today, our infrastructure looks different, but the purpose is identical.
Our interstate highways, power grids, underground subways, sewage plants.
And millions of miles of fiber optic internet cables buried under the ocean. Without these underlying systems operating perfectly every second of every day, modern society would immediately grind to a halt.
That deep definition makes the phrase essential investments so powerful. Think about what an investment is in the financial world. You agree to spend a massive amount of money or effort right now, in the short term, expecting a much larger return later in the future.
Right.
The ancient government spent an absolute fortune, gold, stone, human lives to build these. But the return on their investment wasn't a bag of gold coins. It was the very existence, the public health, and the military expansion of their civilization.
The text says they played a crucial role, an extremely decisive life or death role in their development.
Examining this ancient infrastructure really challenges us to think critically about our world today. We complain constantly about modern infrastructure. We get stuck in traffic because a bridge is being rebuilt, and we get angry. Taxes get raised for a sewer line, and we protest. We take it for granted.
We really do.
But reading this forces you to imagine the alternative. Imagine living in a society with zero infrastructure. Imagine walking 2 miles to a lake and laying down miles of your own hand-dug stone tunnels just to get a clean glass of water for your kids. It puts our minor complaints into perspective, doesn't it?
It truly does, and that's the value of historical texts. They demonstrate that while our specific technologies change stone channels to PVC pipes, scrolls to expert systems, the non-negotiable requirements for civilization remain exactly the same. Managing scarce resources, investing in infrastructure, maintaining public health. The Romans faced them, the Persians faced them, and we face them today.
Exploring those eternal challenges is the perfect way to synthesize this article. We have covered an immense amount of ground today, from the bustling baths of Rome to the dangerous deserts of Persia. deconstructing the English language along the way.
It's been a journey.
Our goal is that you, the listener, walk away feeling incredibly confident if you encounter this passage on your TOEFL exam. You shouldn't feel intimidated by dense vocabulary anymore. You should feel empowered. So to lock this into your long-term memory, let's pull all these threads together and do a quick, comprehensive review of the text's core structure and the vocabulary.
I like to call this reviewing the skeleton of the text. An author builds an argument like an engineer builds an aqueduct. First, the author established the foundation by defining the core concept. Aqueducts transport water. Second, they zoomed in on a specific case study highlighting Roman mastery.
Right, the gravity, the waterproof concrete, the Ponte Guard.
Then came the academic pivot, broadening the global context to show this was a universal human necessity, introducing the Persian underground conduits.
And finally, concluding with the harsh economic realities. The cost, the labor, but ultimately proving they were essential investments in ancient infrastructure.
That's the structural skeleton. Now let's review the flesh and blood, the vocabulary. I'll list the key C1 words, and you, the listener, try to actively recall the Latin roots or historical examples we discussed. Ready?
Let's do it rapid fire.
Engineering feats.
Think of Hercules, not a basic task, but a monumental triumph over impossible odds.
Sustainability.
Prefix, sus, from below, and tenor, to hold. The ability to hold a massive population up without it collapsing.
Spans.
The physical extension of a structure continuously from one side of a valley to the other.
Unique to.
Meaning a characteristic belongs exclusively to one specific group or place.
Tapping.
Piercing into a hidden resource to extract it, like Persians tapping underground aquifers.
Exceptionally durable.
Breaking the rules of normal wear and tear. Unusually tough and capable of lasting for centuries.
Infrastructure.
The infra, or underlying physical systems, roads, pipes, cables, that a society absolutely needs to function.
Then a crucial role.
A decisive, critical, life or death part played in a larger development.
If you can train your brain to recognize these ancient roots, aqua for water, duct for lead, transfer across, port for carry, and understand how these collocations function, the TOEFL reading section transforms. It won't feel like a terrifying test of memorization. You'll actively decode the logic of the author.
I really hope this deep dive has helped you feel more prepared and confident in your English abilities. The English language is this massive, beautiful, complicated puzzle. When you see how all the historical pieces fit together, it's genuinely fun to explore.
It really is.
So as we wrap up our journey today, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to ponder while you finish your run or your commute or your chores. We spent this whole time marveling at the ancient world. But look at our world today. Think about the massive infrastructure we are building right now. Our skyscrapers, our subway systems, our delicate fiber optic internet cables buried under the ocean.
Modern engineering feats.
Exactly. But do you truly believe that any of our modern creations will remain standing in 2,000 years? Do you think the servers running our digital systems will survive 2 millennia of weather, war, and time the same way the 3-tiered stone arches of the Ponte Guard have endured? When you look at the strength of those ancient stones compared to the fragility of our modern technology, it really makes you wonder what true sustainability actually looks like.
That's a profound thought to end on.
This episode was created by Lindy Upgrade Studio.
Good luck with your studies, everyone.
Until next time, keep upgrading your English.